And welcome back. More open lines here. And, of course, checking in on your near-death experiences. Share those stories with us, too. And we'll dive right into the calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's hard to believe Valentine's Day right around the corner as well. Boy, this year's clicking along. A couple more weeks, we'll be into March already. Wow. Then springtime. Just doesn't stop, does it? Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Will in Los Angeles. Thanks for holding, Will. Welcome to the show.
Hey, George. Wow, great show tonight. Great callers you have.
Oh, they are the best, aren't they?
Yeah, so I'll tell you, I had a couple things I wanted to ask about, but I'm going to just change my topic along the lines of things you've been talking about with other people. But I want to also mention something, because I always listen to you really carefully. So one of the things I wanted to get to is something your mom always says. So I want to quote your mom before we're off the call.
Okay.
But before I forget, the one thing about Christopher Plummer, he was in the film, not the original show of Sound of Music, which was in the 1950s, but the film was 1965.
Okay.
And I saw him interviewed once talking about that, and because, you know, he starred with Julie Andrews, who, of course, has an amazing voice.
That's right. At least she did, since she had her problems, of course.
Exactly. She doesn't sing anymore, but yeah. She still is very active and writes books and is terrific. But talking about his own singing in The Sound of Music, he said, oh, well, with me in that movie, it was really the sound of mucus.
Yeah, he really didn't like his part. He did a great job.
Right.
But he said, this movie has been my albatross.
Right, exactly. So, but people remember him for that primarily.
Yep.
But native of Canada, born in Toronto. But so here's when I said thinking about your other callers tonight and how they inspire me. You know, you inspire me, and they do too. The truckers who, you know, I'm a big fan of, like I know you are, and one of them talking about that JC is always with him, and. I tell you, so much, you know, we owe so much to truckers as part of, you know, our, you know, primary workers we can't do without.
And, that's right.
And I tell you that there was my own near-death experience relates to something with a trucker that I saw. Now, I was crossing a road. A country road when I was about 14 years old, and I saw a car was coming up from behind me. It was a pickup truck, and I was like, I better go real quick and avoid getting hit by this car, you know, this truck. And what happens is I get hit, and I'm thrown about 100 feet, and I don't think I died, but my memory that I talked about at the time when I was 14, I talked about it to the ambulance guys, is that it was as if I was like a hockey puck or an air hockey puck. I was just like thrown 100 feet, but I was spinning along the road, but not feeling any, you know, not feeling anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when I stopped and I regained consciousness, I looked up and the windshield was smashed in, and there was, you know, the truck had some damage to it, but the first thing I thought was, oh, are my teeth still there? Because I had braces, and I thought, oh, my mom's going to kill me if I lost my teeth, but my teeth were still there. And anyway, turned out, I thought, when I looked up, I thought if somebody was in the passenger seat in the truck, that maybe, that they must have, like, hit the windshield because it was all bashed, but it was me. And took me to the hospital. They said they were amazed. I had no injuries, internal or external. They kept me, you know, overnight just to be sure. But that made me think of, you know, with the truckers, I tell you, and, you know, thinking about JC, of course, I have three best friends with the initials JC. There's my friend John Karloftis in Lexington, Kentucky, and Joey Kahns, who's a dear friend who I actually bought him a Coast Insider membership.
Oh, did you? That's a great gift.
Yeah, exactly. And he really appreciated it. And so, but those guys, I called John Karlaftis. I called him JC2, and Joey, I called him JC3. And they were like, well, who's JC1? Who's JC1? I said, well, of course, our Savior, Jesus Christ. They were like, okay, well, he could be number one. He could be number one.
He gets that honor.
He gets to be number one, yeah.
That's
and,
right.
But the other thing with the truckers, I just wanted to mention quick before mentioning what your mom always says, or one of the things I know she says, is that I was watching the news, and there was this trucker on a long haul on the New Jersey Turnpike, and these were the reports that there were, you know, there was video of it, that he had to swerve to avoid a mattress that had flown off of somebody's car in front of him, like somebody was moving a mattress.
Right.
And because, you know, he could have gone one way, which would have been fine if he had gone to the left, but he would have caused a major accident, according to all the witnesses there. But instead of going to the left, he went to the right, which meant he went off the road, and it was a fatal accident for this trucker. And so he, like, you know, instead of he made that sacrifice to avoid, you know, having a major accident that he probably would have survived.
Yeah, he saved others, and he lost his life.
Exactly, exactly. And and I'll tell you, I once, after hearing, or sometime around the same time, I was moving some lumber, and I was on a freeway, and a piece of plywood flew off my vehicle, and luckily it went into a safe zone on the side.
Yeah.
But I think, like, you know what, just it's a reminder, I you know, that can happen, and people have to be so careful when you're on the roads. And I was thinking, like, gosh, that trucker who took that sacrifice. But real quick, I'll tell you that there's a movie called Resurrection from 1980 with Ellen Burstyn.
Okay.
And that movie is about dying and having a near-death experience, but coming back with the power to heal. This woman becomes a healer. And it's a movie that I recommend for anyone who has these interests, like this topic that your show always touches on. And the movie is called Resurrection, and it's a beautiful movie. And she has the power to heal, and she says it comes from God, and God is love, and vice versa. And so, you know, that idea that so much is inexplainable in our lives, and but just like, you know, your mom always said, George, you know, we can't explain things. Just like the Big Bang Theory, like we were talking about last night with your guest, but some things always were and always will be.
You got that right. Well, you got her quoted perfectly. She has said that for years and years since I've been a little boy. Thanks, Will, and I appreciate that. Thomas is with us in Rancho Cucamonga, California.
Hey, George, it's me, Thomas, from Rancho Cucamonga, California.
Hi, Thomas.
I got a question to you. Two questions and comments for a few minutes. Was awful autistic, yes or no? And also, what did you and our parents did in World War II when it got drafted by the Army?
Well, I got to tell you what, my dad was in World War II, Thomas, and he was in the Battle of the Bulge in Germany, and did not like talking about it. I was never able to get a lot of information from him. He gave me some artifacts. As a matter of fact, he gave me his army helmet, and that is what it is. And you sound like you've battled your autism perfectly. So you keep doing the right thing. Let's go to Tom, who's got a text or tweet. What do you have, Tommy?
Hey, this one from Devin in Tallahassee, Florida. I've never heard you talk about playing an instrument. Did you ever try?
I tried two things. I tried the clarinet, and I gave that up after a couple of years.
This is going to be good.
This is when I was in real, you know, school, 13, 14 years old. And then I tried the guitar.
How'd you do in the guitar?
Not well. Not well.
You'd be playing it.
And then, you know, when I started doing then, because I always loved singing, as you well know, That's what I decided to concentrate on because I wasn't musically inclined with an instrument. I sang, and I think I made up my difference.
It is so amazing people that have such talent for instruments. It really is.
Oh, my gosh.
To me, it is.
Yep. But, you know, because the era of the big band is gone, I'm wondering if we have anybody coming up who are great saxophone players, trumpet players, and stuff like that. I don't know if that exists anymore.
I don't think so. Not like that era.
I mean, those days are gone. I mean, you think of those Vegas, you know, orchestras. Sinatra used to have, what, how many? 50, 70 people?
I started out my career as a big band DJ. I used to play all that music. It was so good.
Did you?
Oh, yeah.
Did you like that?
Oh, it was great. Are you kidding? We had a big, big room with nothing but records. Old records, Louis Prima, all that stuff. You pull your own stuff and play it.
That Louis Prima, Keeley Smith song I play every once in a while. Old Black Magic.
Yeah.
Classics.
It's all classic stuff.
Would you have liked to have been in Vegas in the 50s and 60s?
No, because I don't like the whole being buried thing in the desert if you do the wrong thing.
You think you would have?
I don't know. It's Vegas. Who knows?
All right. Back to the calls. Tom in Riverside, California. Hello, Tom. Welcome. Hello, Tom. Yeah,
I'm here.
There you are.
Yeah, I was just going to, you were talking about Christopher Plummer, and I remember a particular part. I don't know what the movie was. All I remember is he's playing Caesar, I think, or it's the Roman times, you know, and he gets stabbed, and he's dying, and he's got this quirky way, you know, of his personality of dying, and he's kind of half smiling. And he's laying there dying. He's saying, if you listen very closely, you can hear the gods laughing. You know, he just does it really well. But I don't know who what movie it was, but somebody listening probably knows what it is. But I remember him playing that part really well. He was a very good actor in all his movies, sure. But that part, it stuck in my mind. I remember that when you were talking about it. And then also, I wanted to bring up that, you know, you mentioned your dad in the Army and, you know, my uncles, my best friend up there, close to where I lived right there, was in the Marines, and they was in the National Guard, you know, when I was growing up, and his son. And those people never talked about the war.
No, they didn't. They did not like doing that for some reason. And I'm sure my dad saw some horrendous things, but he didn't like talking about it.
No, they didn't. You know, I had a lot of uncles, and my dad was in the Navy, and they never brought it up. Anyway, that's all I got. I just want to throw that in there.
All right, thanks, Tom. A lot of us really don't understand how good we have it today, thanks to what they did then during that generation. Wayne in Tacoma, Washington. Hello there, Wayno.
Good evening, George. I wanted to bring up a couple of things that happened to me in the past that are two of them were kind of close calls to death, I would say. And I'm not a professional driver or a trick driver or anything, but going down Highway 99 going between Seattle and Everett, Washington, going by the old Kmart store up there, late at night, rain was just pouring down hard. Everybody was going a little too fast after work, maybe 65 miles an hour there.
Mm-hmm. Too fast.
Right in front of me, people were stopped, you know, so I slammed on the brakes and started the slide, and I was going to slide right into the guy in front of me, so I did, did the quick maneuver and went around him on the outside. Fortunately, there was room enough to go around him on the outside, and the guy behind me, of course, hit the guy in front of me. Same thing happened down in Portland, Oregon. A few years difference between the two. Nice sunny day that day. Beautiful day, hot day. People stopped real fast. I was able to whip around him, and the guy behind me hit the guy in front of me again. Those are close calls, but here's a near-death call. This happened in the mid-1960s. Probably about 67, 68, went out to take the family boat out to empty the water out that accumulated in the bottom during the winter rains.
Right.
Wasn't fully covered. Started the boat, got up there on the middle of the Sound, Henderson Inlet in Olympia, Washington. Started doing about maybe 20 miles an hour. Got the boat going straight and good. Had a little too much power on the motor, though, and walked to the back, pulled the plugs to dump the 30 or 40 gallons that had accumulated in the bottom of the boat. All of a sudden, the motor jerks, and there's no handle on the motor to grab, to straighten it out. It was just operated by a steering wheel, and the boat just went into just a spin, and flipped over.
And, the entire boat flipped right over, like upside down?
Yeah, flipped over. I grabbed the edge because I didn't want to get in. I grabbed the edge with all my might because I didn't want to get hit up by the props. The boat flips over, goes down underwater. I could hear the motor chug, 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 sucking in water. And after about a minute, I realized, well, I wasn't dead, and I wanted to live. And I was in shock, and I was in really cold water in the middle of the winter.
Were you still in the boat underneath, or did you get?
Yeah, my neighbor, Mr. Fletcher, an airline pilot for Pan Am, who had just built a log cabin house next to our house there on the bay, was home that day. He saw the boat flip. He came down and got his little pram, a boat, and came out and saved my life. And the boat was still floating by the top air bubble that was in the front of the boat. And so he hooked onto the boat and he pulled the boat in. So he saved both me and the boat that day. Unfortunately, the motor was toast and that had to be rebuilt, but my life was saved.
Jeez. And how old were you?
At that time, I would have been about 20. No, 19. 19.
Just a kid.
Yeah.
Just a kid. Saved, to be sure. Man, everybody's had near-death experiences. It's amazing how many people have gotten out of it. Chris in South Dakota, first-time caller. Hi, Chris. Welcome.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you. What's up?
Yeah, I just figured I'd tell you a story I had when I was a kid.
Okay.
Well, it has to do with UFOs, and I was just about 1982, and I looked out my kitchen window where I was grabbing some food as a kid, and my little brother pointed at something, and I saw it. It was sitting out the front yard and stuff like that. And when I finally got curious, I tried to get my brothers and my family to go out, but they never did. And eventually I lost my fear, and I went out there and saw this, and there were three beings looking angelic-looking.
Jeez.
You know, and it was like that. They were holographic and you could see circuits in there.
And no way were they human beings, right?
No, they weren't human beings at all. And the place was so lit up, there wasn't even a shadow showing and stuff like that. Even the cracks in the fence were lit up. I mean, it was just no dark.
What'd they do eventually? Just get in and take off?
Well, what happened was these halos shot up into the vehicle and the creatures followed and they went into this wedge-shaped ship, and they took off, and they shot straight up, did a zigzag, and like faster than a spitball, man, they hauled out towards the northeast.
That's a great story. I mean, there's no doubt there's something going on. I mean, too many people like you have witnessed too many very strange things, and it's bizarre. I still think they're coming from other planetary systems. They have a unique propulsion system, or they've learned how to bend space and time, and they travel that way. There's no way they're traveling the way we do right now. But I feel that they're coming from other planets in our solar system as opposed to other dimensions or other multiverses or places like that. Or speaking of UFOs, we're going to come back and talk about some alien implants in a moment. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We'll have George Knapp. We'll be hosting tomorrow night, Saturday, and I'll be back Sunday night, first Sunday with Emerging Artists, talk a little bit about the Super Bowl and a couple of great guests for you. Alien implants. Now, no one knew the subject better than the deceased Roger Lear. His associate, Steve Colburn, knew Dr. Lear very, very well. You were pretty close with Roger, weren't you?
Yeah, I was his partner for, from 2008 to about 6 years, 2008 to 2014 when he passed away.
What a loss. What a loss.
Yeah.
Steve.
Yeah, it's certainly not as fun to go to conventions, and the whole field is poorer without him, for sure. He was one of the most knowledgeable individuals in this field I've ever seen.
Wasn't he involved in some kind of car crash, which may have contributed to his untimely death?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was not in good health when I knew him. His circulatory system was shot. I'm not sure why. Maybe too much fried food or something earlier in life. But in any event, he was not in very good health. But he was, in well enough health. He was well enough to go to conventions and do the research and such. But he had a car crash about 2 years before he died led to a downward spiral of his health, and he got shingles right after that, and then got a bad ulcer on his ankle that would not heal.
Jeez.
And he eventually ended up having to have vascular surgery to get it to heal, and he dodged a bullet on that one, and it did finally heal. But then only a few months after that, that injury finally healed up after he had the surgery and everything. He dropped a book on the ankle of the other leg.
Ouch.
Which led to another serious wound that would not heal and eventually got infected. And they were preparing to do vascular surgery on the other leg when he died of an apparent heart attack.
He was a great guy.
Yeah, he was.
We miss him a lot. How did you first meet him?
I first met Dr. Lear when I was working about maybe half a mile from his Camarillo office. And I had always been interested in UFOs and thought his research was fascinating. And then I knew that he worked only a few blocks away, and thought, it'd be fascinating to see some of those implants. And I never thought I would actually get to.
And he was a podiatrist by trade, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife and I had a lot of strange happenings, especially after we had children, that led me to believe that we were having some abduction activity.
Uh-huh.
I'd had missing time experiences before that I'd told her about before we got married, and she told me that she'd been scanned at night by what it was, I would think, probably a hologram. She said it looked like a large piece of metal up on him, like a piece of sheet metal that went slowly from head to toe on her, and it had colors coming out of it, and she said it looked real pretty. But she said that she started getting scared and tried to wake me up, and the second I started waking up, it turned into a red beam of light and shot out the window. And she also had red triangular marks on her abdomen and such during a couple of pregnancies. And anyway, we had all stuff like that happen. And then one night after the birth of our daughter in February of 2008, I was in the house alone. I had to water the plants and such, and it got late, and I got tired. And she was over at her mom's house, so I said I was going to just spend the night in the house alone. And I saw these two huge raccoons out in the yard, and one was about 70 pounds. I didn't even know they got that big, so I watched the animals for a while, and they seemed semi-tame, and I fed them some cat food and then went to bed. And I woke up in the morning about 8 o'clock and felt kind of hungover and had kind of a bruised feeling on the side of my head and a stinging sensation in my toe. And there were two puncture wounds on the bottom of my toe, and each of them lit up bright green under ultraviolet light. And I didn't remember anything consciously at the time, although I remembered consciously some stuff about aliens before, but this time I did not remember anything consciously, but I just knew that they'd been there during the night and that I had two more implants. And so I thought, well, I've got to investigate this somehow. I mean, this is just something I can't ignore anymore. I was kind of in denial for a long time because I didn't have any real evidence, but I thought, well, this might be just the evidence that I would need to say one way or the other whether this is real or not. And I scheduled an appointment with Dr. Lear a couple of weeks later. And just told him I had a, the first visit, I just told him I had a foreign body in my toe. And he said he told me to come back and see if it would go away. And I came back the next week and told him it was about a possible alien abduction. And I don't think he believed me at first, but he told me to.
Was he into that at that time?
Yeah, he was into that. He started in 1994, before my time in the project. Daryl Sims was in with him at that time. And I guess they broke up around 2002 or thereabouts, and I came on board about 2008. And in any event, he gave me a prescription to get the toe x-rayed and said to give a copy of the film to the patient. And I knew that I just knew, I had a gut feeling I was going to see something on the x-ray film. But when they gave me that film and I looked at it and I saw something, that changed my life forever. I mean, it's one thing, it's quite different to strongly suspect that you're being abducted by aliens. It's quite another matter to know for sure.
What did this implant look like?
It looked like a bent piece of wire on the x-ray, and it looked smaller on the x-ray than it turned out to be in reality, surprisingly enough. And there's a picture of it. There's an x-ray picture of it on that paper I sent you. And that the paper where it talks about the John Smith implant. I referred to myself for a while as John Smith about this because I did not want to, you know, go public about it immediately.
Right, no, I understand.
I must have analyzed it rather than an abductee as well.
Now, when I met Dr. Lear, it was in 2003, and he was conducting a implant removal out of a woman who had some kind of object in her cheek. And, you know, every time he got close to her mouth and the cheek, it would move. He had a heck of a time getting it pulled out. But he finally did.
I heard part of that show. That was pretty fascinating.
Yeah. And I was just interested in everything he did after that. Now, in your particular case, was he ever able to analyze what they were?
Yeah, we did an extensive analysis on my implant and the Ron Noel implant. That was the patient number 16 implant that came right after me. I was patient number 15. There are several types of implants, but the most common type is a metal core with a surface of what seems to be like a mother of pearl or a bone or a biological hard part over that. And there's probably enzymes in that that this is speculation at this point, but there's most likely enzymes in that that lead to the blood plasma or plasmas in the proteins rather in the host body turning into a black electrically conductive membrane that goes around the object. And nerve cells grow into that. There must be chemical cues in it for nerve cells to grow in it, nerve growth factor and such. And in any event, proprioceptor nerves grow into that membrane. And on some of them, the membrane is substituted by a layer of epithelial tissue that's not supposed to be there. It's very out of sorts for proprioceptor nerves to be in those areas of the body as well. They're usually used for the body's sensing position.
Are these implants? Can they be altered? Can they be cut or anything like that?
Yeah, they differ a lot in hardness. Mine was actually quite brittle. Instead of trying to take it out in one piece, dissecting it out, Dr. Matriciano, who did most of the removal, tried to come in from the side of the toe and pull it out, and it broke into 12 pieces when he tried to remove it that way because it was brittle. And that turned out to be a good thing because it gave us a good look at the inside of the device. Dr. Lehrer gave me two pieces of it to analyze after the operation. And the Ron Noel implant, though, first of all, mine was brittle because it had relatively large micron size carbon nanotube concentrations that acted as stress concentrations that made the metal brittle. The Ron Noel implant, on the other hand, had a higher concentration of carbon nanotubes, but they were well dispersed. And carbon nanotubes are the world's strongest known material. So, earthly science is trying to use them to strengthen metal in current research, and the aliens have evidently perfected the process. And that metal was the strongest we'd ever seen. Diamond tools would not touch it.
Could you see the object with the naked eye, or did you need like a microscope?
We could see with the naked eye. The object was about 4 millimeters long by a little less than 1 millimeter in diameter. Mine and the Ron Noel implant looked like more like a seed. It was kind of
grain of rice, that kind of size.
What's that?
Like a grain of rice.
Yeah, like a small grain of rice, perhaps. And the Ron Noel implant was about the same volume, but it was more triangular. It looked kind of like the Star Trek communication badges in shape, sort of like that. And it was extremely, extremely strong. If you could build a submarine hull or something out of that material, it wouldn't need to be very thick, for sure. They would go quite to the bottom of the ocean. That would be worth a lot of money if we could produce a material like that ourselves.
Have you come up with a theory, Steve, of what the devices are generally? Are they tracking devices in people? What are they?
Well, I think it goes without saying that they all can be used for tracking, but I don't think that's the primary purpose of a lot of them. I think that the one they put in my toe was a physiological monitoring device of some kind, probably to monitor things like blood sugar and temperature and how far the subject walks, blood pressure, stuff like that. And Dr. Kuntz, who was our partner for a while, thought that the characteristics of the device were such that it could be used as a room bug as well to directly transmit airborne sounds.
Could they make you do something almost like a Manchurian candidate? Could they, you know, change your thought patterns or anything like that?
I have reason to believe that they can. Yeah, I've talked to in the course of my research on alien abduction. I've talked to several hundred experiencers, and many have reported doing things that were out of character, and looking back on it, thought that probably the aliens were involved. There's no way to prove it for sure, but there's a very good reason to believe that they can implant thoughts into people with these implants. And a lot of people have brain implants too. The standard procedure seems to be for the Greys to put an implant into the brain of people that they plan to take a lot, like the one Whitley Strieber described in the book Communion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It goes up the nose. And somebody actually sent me one of those that was said to be sneezed out of someone before it could implant. And I remember the aliens telling me, I just remember spontaneously them telling me that they're made of a conductive polymer. And it was very interesting that when I analyzed that particular implant that this person sent me, another scientist sent me, it was made of a conductive polymer, and what I think they've told me leads me to believe that the implant uses proteins found in the brain and the blood plasma to build more conductive polymer and build like conductive polymer wires to various parts of the brain, I think they can utilize. They can do partial control, but not full control. And they can also access the subject's sensory information, see through your eyes, hear through your ears, stuff like that.
Well, when you said some partial control, I mean, could these implants indeed make somebody do something they didn't want to do?
I think so. What I've noticed in my own experiences is that sometimes they can make you have an obsession to do something, and it's especially dangerous and hard to fight, because the subject almost always thinks it's their idea unless they've had extensive experience with it and know what to look for.
How do you find the implants in a human body, because they're so small?
Well, I'm using Dr. Lear's techniques that he taught me. One of the most useful techniques is to just simply go over the subject with a stud finder, which is a small metal detector used to detect nails and walls.
And that'll register it, huh?
Yeah, it registers them quite nicely. And another really good technique is to use a gauss meter, which detects very faint magnetic fields, to go over the body, because these implants almost always have a strong magnetic field for their size.
For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.